Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby up at Simon Fraser University. We're also on the internet at cjsf.ca, where you can stream and podcast Endeavors, as well as all your other favorite CJSF shows. And we're also on high definition television channel 7014. We have a great, great show today. My first guest, you might know him best as the author of The Commitments, Roddy Doyle. He has a new book out called The Guts, which revisits Commitment founder and manager Jimmy Rabbit Jr. 25 years later. How's he doing? What's going on with his life? We'll talk to Roddy about why he decided to revisit this character. What's changed, you know, in Ireland, in Dublin, in the last 20, 25 years? And also, what about that Commitments musical? My second guest is CNN journalist John D. Suter, whose new project is Change the List. And we'll get into him with that and sort of social justice journalism. He talks about a lot of different issues. There's rape in Alaska, income inequality. So we'll get to a heart of a lot of those issues with John. And then our musical guest today is great Vancouver garage duo The Pack AD. They have a couple new albums out, Do Not Engage and Some Songs. We're going to start with a song off their full-length album, Do Not Engage. This is Stalking Is Normal. This is The Pack AD with Stalking Is Normal.
It's easy to see there's a villain inside of me, but everyone's busy enjoying my disease. I close my eyes inside and I see the ending. Everything short inside and crooked and bending, and it burns, burns.
Turns.
I will destroy what we have done.
Once again, that was the Pack AD with Stalking Is Normal off of their album Do Not Engage, and we'll be hearing from the Pack AD a little later on in the show. But right now, you know my first guest best as the author of the Barrytown trilogy, starting with his seminal novel The Commitments, which was turned into a hit 1991 film. Also part of that trilogy, The Snapper and The Van, both of which were also turned into hit independent films. Of course, in 1993, he won the Booker Prize for his novel Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha. He has also written the screenplays for the films When Brendan Met Trudy, New Boy, and Family, and a memoir about his parents, the 2002 book Rory and Ita. His new book is The Guts, which revisits the character of Jimmy Rabbit Jr., co-founder and management of The Commitments, from the 1991 novel. He is Roddy Doyle, and I spoke to him last week here in Vancouver. I'm here with Roddy Doyle, author of The Guts. Hello, Roddy.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
You're talking to your laptop.
Yes. So, this book, Jimmy Rabbit, obviously the character most known from The Commitments.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to revisit this character?
I think because when the Irish economy collapsed some years ago, the word recession re-entered the vocabulary, or the active vocabulary, and I wrote The Commitments in the middle of a deep recession in Ireland, although we didn't know it was a recession, we just thought it was normal life. And I wondered if those characters were real, Jimmy and his family and his friends, how they would be getting on in this new recession, which struck me immediately as being very different. Because actually a lot of the coverage, the early coverage of the boom, or people trying to explain, or not the boom, but the collapse, people trying to explain it, there's a lot of this nostalgia. There were a lot of references to the 1980s, a lot of 1980s soundtrack music even, you know, pop songs from the 80s. And struck me as being lazy. So I just thought I'd bring Jimmy back, add the years, quite a lot of years, about 25 years to his life, and to see how, as a middle-aged man, he was getting on. So that's the idea. I had never any intention of going back to him, really, but it just struck me as creatively a good thing to do, you know? Not a good, as in moralistically a good thing to do, but a potentially good thing.
You mentioned the recession, and that brings up the idea of, like, how would you compare Dublin now with Dublin 20, 25 years ago when you first wrote The Commitments?
Well, it's very hard in a way, because any place, regardless of economic conditions, is going to change dramatically in a quarter of a century. You know, so Dublin, there's a consistency to it, and there's a lot that's the same, but actually, you know, if you were away for 25 years and you start wandering around, there's so much that's different, you know, there's a lot of buildings that weren't there. It's more cosmopolitan in many ways. Perhaps on the main streets, it's a bit more bland. It's like every main street in every Western city in the world, you know. Same branches of the same shops or stores, you know, and Starbucks. So, but when you go turn the corner and go off the main streets, I think there's a consistency to it. Probably the biggest difference would be the proportion of foreign nationals in Ireland, or people who've emigrated to Ireland. 1 in 10, apparently, according to the last census, which was taken after the economic collapse. So these people are, you know, obviously staying. And that wouldn't have been the case 25 years ago. A small proportion, very, very, very small proportion, would have been born outside of Ireland. Now it's more, and in that 1 in 10, it's not, what it isn't reflected is their children who were born in Ireland. You know? So it's much more complicated cultural picture than it used to be.
There's a great line for me in the book where he says, "It's the new austerity. Youth has been cancelled." How has the sort of the financial crunch and austerity members, how have you found it affected sort of the next generation of people?
Well, if the next generation are people who are significantly younger than me, a lot of them have emigrated. You know, they're here, actually, in Canada. Toronto is a big popular spot. Australia, London. So they've emigrated. There's a fluidity to the emigration, I think, though. They're much more flexible and they're, you know, I'd imagine if and when things pick up, they'll be coming back. There's already a bank in Ireland offering mortgages for people who are living outside of Ireland but thinking of returning. If that's a sign of optimism, great. But so young people have always left Ireland. It is a small place, you know. Dublin's great, but it's a large city by European standards, but it's a small city by global standards, really. It isn't New York and it isn't London. You know, it doesn't have the allure because it's home in many, many ways that other places have. So people have always left. The big difference being now, of course, is that they have to, you know, because there's no work. There's very little work for it. And it's an educated workforce now as well. So it's not like Irish people going abroad to work on building sites, although they do. And they do a lot of manual work, but actually a lot of them are highly educated, you know. So they're going abroad to find work that isn't available in Ireland. There was the country, all these things are very inaccurate, you know. They're not accurate measures of anything. But it struck me for the first few years that the country was a bit stunned, you know, a bit afraid to breathe. And it did appear that typically, I suppose, some of the traits of life that we might typically associate with Ireland weren't there. But things seem to have calmed down now. And there's a kind of general acceptance that you've been in a deep, deep hole, and maybe, you know, with a bit of luck, you might be able to climb out of it.
The Celts, to me, are known for their storytelling prowess. Where did you acquire yours?
I don't actually buy into the whole Celt thing. I don't consider myself a Celt. It doesn't have any meaning whatsoever to me. I don't know, you know, beyond a few generations, what my roots are. I think they're Irish. But as to what the Celt thing means, I don't know. I don't feel any particular affinity with Welsh people or Scottish people. That's not a hostile notion by any means. But, you know, I like both places, but I don't actually feel any cultural affinity whatsoever with them. If we're talking about the Irish storytelling, I think we enjoy talking. I think pound for pound we probably talk more than the average British person does. I'm not sure, but I think we probably do. Talk a lot of shite. But if we hear a joke, we make it into a story. It becomes something that happened. And I grew up, you know, hearing stories constantly. Events during the day, magnified into big things. Events about my parents' past, their parents' involvement in the War of Independence, for example, constant stories. I just grew up with it, you know, as did, you know, a lot of Irish people. But I don't think there's anything Celtic about it. You know, as I said, I don't think.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of contradictory historical perspectives on whether this Celtic thing is actually has any legitimacy whatsoever. I think it's it worries me sometimes because it's bordering on some sort of racial supremacy sometimes, you know. It's not a way I want to go.
One of the big things that's big in this book is the Eucharistic Congress, and I'm wondering how important you feel religion and Catholicism is to the Irish identity, and if you feel that it's maybe changing at all.
Well, I would, if you were asking me that question 30 years ago, I'd have said very important. I'd probably have said very important, unfortunately, because I'm not religious myself. And it was inflicted. I grew up Catholic, but I kind of decided, well, I didn't kind of decide, I decided in my late teens that it wasn't for me. And it was a bit of a fight in my early adult years. I had to constantly reassert my right not to be Catholic. You know, as a school teacher, for example, constantly remind people that, no, I don't go to Mass, no, you know, I'm not involved in this thing. Now, nobody gives a toss, really, nobody cares. The power of the Catholic Church is still there, but it's greatly diminished. And most, vast majority of people are in favour of the separation of church and state and education and health. But the relic is still there. Probably a long time before it is finally separated, if it actually occurs at all. But religion, I don't think, is a vital part of people's day-to-day lives. It's in the language. I mean, if I look out the window and it's not raining, I might say to myself, thank God, even though I don't believe. So it's in the language and probably always will be. I wouldn't ever kind of even consider trying to, you know, if you like, exile it or delete it from my own vocabulary. That would be absolutely daft. But the clout that the Catholic Church had up until very recently is gone. You know, it's gone. And very often now the churches are full of immigrants, you know. There are some places where they'd be full of Catholic Nigerians and Polish people would be filling the churches and not, if you like, Irish-born people. So times have changed a lot.
Another discussion that happens a little bit in this book is about Facebook. You know, he's looking for his brother. How, for you, has social media changed the way stories like yourselves are accessible to people?
I haven't a clue, really. I don't really know. I think possibly it's only 10 years old, is it, Facebook? Yeah, it's where it was around for hundreds of years, but it's only 10 years old, so its impact, I think, will only be known really down the line. And I know that goes against the whole ethos of Facebook and social media. Immediate answers are needed and wanted, but I don't know. I think it's all quite shallow, really. I opened a Facebook account of my own because I needed it. I didn't need it, but I needed to see what it was like as research for the novel. And I've held on to it, and I kind of enjoy it, contributing to it. But I, you know, scroll down through it, and, you know, I don't think pictures of puppy dogs and announcements that somebody's cousin died are going to change people's outlook on anything. There is an immediate, there's a kind of hostility to a lot of social media. I'm talking now as somebody looking at it from a distance, which I find disturbing. Immediate. Even the Woody Allen, Mia Farrow issue. Immediate, where you're either for it or against it, with them or against it. It seems to be that almost like-unlike thing. And that I find a bit disturbing, you know, because it seems to me that information is secondary to immediate opinion, you know. So I don't really know how it'll work out, possibly because I don't fully understand it either. Twitter isn't an area I want to go into at all, because as far as I can see, it's a very hostile world. I don't want to be in there.
So, your three previous novels about this family and the Barrytown trilogy were turned into films. Any news about this one being turned into a film?
No, there's been no... As far as I know, there's been no inquiries. As far as I know, no inquiries. I'm certainly... not waiting for the whole thing to happen. I've no ambitions or wishes about it whatsoever. It'd be daft of me to start thinking about it even. So it's very important. I found when for a while, my writing career would have been, you know, both novels and screenplays. Really, really important for me to separate the two and not allow future considerations leak into the novel I'm working on at the moment. So I never for a second while I was writing The Goods thought about, you know, how would this work on screen? Because that'll just, you know, get in the way and also probably dilute it. I'd be coming, I wouldn't put in the little meandering bits that are actually a very, very important part of most of my work. So I don't, I separate the two. And having finished the book, and now it's out there, nobody has inquired as far as I know. And that's fine with me because I'm in no hurry to do anything about it.
Now, I recently read that the Commitments was finally turned into a musical.
That's right.
And I know 20 years ago you turned down the opportunity. What was different this time?
Years. The separation of years. When the Commitments movie was released, I had published my third novel, I think, by then. But it was a monster in Ireland. And I think I measure a lot of things according to my immediate surroundings, because that's where I live. And I felt a bit burdened by it after a while and bored with it in a way. And at that point, I suppose I was still young, very young. I was worried that I'd be defined by this for the rest of my life. And I thought, enough is enough. It was great. I was very happy with the film, very happy with the experience of writing the screenplay. You know, really, really delighted and surprised that a self-published novel would eventually be a movie. So it was all great, but I thought, let's call it enough is enough. So there were almost immediate inquiries about the stage rights, and I had retained them, they were mine. And I said, no, I just wanted to get on. I wrote my novel, Paddy Clark, and I was writing the screenplay of the film that became The Snapper. So I just had no interest in it, and I'd never been to a musical. In a word association test, somebody had said, you know, musical, I'd have said Sound of Music, and I hate it. I think it's shite. I really do hate it. And I didn't, that's what I thought musicals were. Later on, when my children were born and got a bit older, now and again I'd go to London with them, you know, and we'd go to a show on a Saturday night, and I began to see, you know, some really good ones. You know, really enjoyed them. Spamalot, The Producers, Jersey Boys, I think. The two that really surprised me, The Lion King, you know, I went with my daughter, not expecting anything from it. I just thought an adaptation of the movie, and I knew that, you know, people of my age with children probably know that movie inside out, they're off by heart. And actually, visually, it was just stunning, you know, it was a great night. And the other one was Billy Elliot. Thought it was a nice film, very good the film, but the musical was a total surprise, an entirely different experience, and brilliant, really brilliant, possibly better than the movie. So these things opened my head, and the inquiries had been reasonably consistent. So at some point, myself and my agent got the file out and just contacted everybody who inquired over the years. So I changed my mind, really. But I needed that time. You know, I needed the time.
Your knowledge of music and love of music is apparent. So who are some of your favorite bands today, or who would you recommend?
There's a band, a mixture of British and French women called Savages. They've one album, came out last year, and I love that. I haven't really played a lot in the last 2 weeks, haven't been away. There's an Irish band. They play kind of what's often called post-rock music. It's kind of almost formless instrumental music. Kind of a first cousin of heavy metal, and not unlike Mogwai. They're called And So I Watch You From Afar. And I think they're from, I'm not sure, they might be from Belfast or Derry. I think they're excellent. I've seen them live. And they're a great, great show. There's a band called Villagers. It's actually one guy called Conor O'Brien. He's brilliant. He's kind of just on the wise side of singer-songwriter, you know. But his lyrics are really clever, and the songs, the melodies are just brilliant. So I think he's really, really, really excellent. There, I mean, there are old faithful ones like Bill Callahan, and I listen to him a lot at the moment, and Prefab Sprout. They have an album out, you know, for the first time in a long time. And again, it's Paddy McAloon, in fact, Prefab Sprout. And just glorious stuff to listen to, really beautiful. They're the things that spring to mind today.
Well, the book is The Guts. It's a great read. Roddy Doyle, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And that was Roddy Doyle, whose new book, The Guts, is out now. It's a great read. I had a chance to read it. I highly recommend it. It's a really, really lot of emotion in that piece, but a lot of, you know, that classic, witty Irish humor as well. So check it out. And in honor of Roddy Doyle, he recommended the Savages. So we've got a CD by the Savages here. This album is Silence Yourself, and this is the song Strife. And that was Savages with Strife. Okay, my next guest is a human rights and social change columnist with CNN. His new project is called Change the Lists, and some of his pieces within that have included The Most Unequal Place in America, The Rapist Next Door, and The County Where No One's Gay. He is John D. Suter, and he joined me by phone a couple of weeks ago. Joining me on the phone now is John D. Suter from CNN's Change the List. Hello, John. Welcome to the show. So I'm fascinated by this Change the List thing that you're doing. How did this project begin for you?
Issues that you talk about. I know a big one in the States is income inequality, and that's and issues affecting the poor, and we're seeing a lot of policy discussion around that. One of them is the raising of the minimum wage. What do you make of the debate that's happening around that?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, income inequality has sort of been a topic that's been discussed in America for a while, but it's really come into the public consciousness in a real way in the last, you know, year or so. The debate about the minimum wage, I mean, I've written publicly about supporting an increase in the minimum wage. I've talked to people and written about people who work minimum wage jobs or even above that and still really struggle to get by. The minimum wage as it currently exists is worth less than the minimum wage was in the 1960s. And I think if people realize that, they, you know, might get more behind that policy shift. So to me, the real heart of the income inequality debate is the gap between the rich and the poor. It's not just about poverty. It's also about excessive and skyrocketing wealth and the division between increasingly becoming a two-class society. And I think the bigger that gap gets, the less people can understand each other and the less likely it will be that we come up with smart policies together that make, the country stronger. And I think that gap in, like, empathy and the gap in trust are, you know, go right alongside the gap in income, and that is part of, to me, what's most troubling about it.
A lot of the opponents will say that an increase of the minimum wage takes away the impetus to try harder or you know, to fight for success.
I mean, I think the people who are unemployed or working minimum wage jobs are trying plenty hard, and often the jobs aren't available or they don't pay well enough to actually support a family. So to me, that that's a significant issue. If someone is willing to work hard and you know, give their best effort and work full time, they should be able to live on that wage. I don't think that's currently the case in many communities in the country.
So, you know, obviously you're doing this Change the List project, but are there any other issues, you know, currently facing the states that you haven't covered yet that you want to, or that you're thinking about covering in the future?
One of the things I really love about this project is the readers are the driving force behind it. It kind of has a populist ethic in that way. And so, I mean, the upcoming stories that they've voted for, that they've identified as hugely important in the U.S. and abroad are, the three that are left are wildlife trafficking, childhood poverty internationally, and then also endangered or polluted rivers in the U.S. So those are my, next major focus areas. I think that there are a number of interesting policy debates that are going on in the U.S. right now, from immigration to, you know, what you mentioned with the minimum wage, and LGBT rights has been something that I've been, you know, very forward about advocating for, and I think needs to remain in the public conversation too.
What did you make of the State of the Union address by President Barack Obama?
profound and on point. I have argued that I would like to see that conversation broadened and to see other leaders in the U.S. and artists and musicians and people bringing this issue up. You know, President Obama, like, to his credit, has been talking about income inequality for years. I just don't know that it necessarily is sinking in. So, you know, I would like to see more people, like, jump into that conversation. But, you know, I applaud him for, you know, for bringing that up.
Considering Obama, you know, came in to power with a huge deficit left by Bush, how do you think he has done on the issue of the economy?
I mean, I think that that is, you know, a little bit, like, outside the scope of, like, this, you know, this project that I'm doing, like, all of his economic policies in general. Like, the issue that I've been trying to focus on, you know, most prominently is that of income inequality and trying to address that. And I think that poses, like, really tricky policy questions for, you know, anyone here or abroad. And, you know, I think we've got to keep looking for solutions. And I've written, you know, about looking for those here as well as in, you know, in other countries. Canada has a problem with income inequality. It's been rising there. I, you know, wrote about a Swiss referendum that came up a few months ago, you know, about establishing sort of a ratio for wages. You know, I've talked to people who've looked at the economy in Brazil and cash transfer programs to try to reduce income inequality. So I think this really is, you know, in many ways a global conversation. And I think income inequality is at the heart of a lot of the economic troubles that people are seeing.
Now, I think I read on your website that you were trying to run a marathon before the anniversary of Boston.
Yeah.
How is that going for you?
Thanks for asking about that. So after, you know, after the Boston Marathon bombing, I saw a lot of people on Twitter primarily, you know, posting about wanting to run a marathon in response. It's sort of like a form of protest, like not, you know, letting this event win and not letting people be afraid of running a marathon. There was a lot of, you know, fear immediately after that in the races that followed. I've really never been a runner. But I, you know, agreed to do that and encouraged our readers and people on Scene and I Report to pledge to run races or marathons as well. I finished mine in November. I ran it in North Carolina in the Outer Banks, which is like along the coast. And it was an amazing and like wonderful experience. I had, you know, a blast, and I will be, you know, writing about that like before the anniversary comes up. And it's just been really heartening to hear stories from readers and iReporters who have, you know, joined on with that movement and have done this as well. I think it's a neat community thing in a way to, you know, both honor the you know, the victims there and to sort of stand in solidarity.
Going back to your project a little bit, and, you know, we've been talking about income equality and this issue in Alaska, and I'm curious if you found any relationship between, you know, the rape victims and their social or their economic status.
What do you mean by their social status?
Like, for example, like were a lot of the rape victims, you know, low income earners, for example.
So I talked to someone at the University of Alaska Anchorage about sort of who was most affected by rape, and what he told me I thought was a little bit surprising, which is that it is across all groups in Alaska. They've done surveys regionally and found that in different regions of the state, the prevalence remains high everywhere. You know, it's high in Anchorage, which is, you know, a large city. It's high in rural areas. It's high in Juneau. It's high in different, you know, different groups. I think, you know, income, race, you can cut it different ways, and it is a persistent problem. I don't think it's defined to one group, and I think it's something that state really needs to wrestle with and discuss and to do it as a whole and as one state community or as one country, not by pushing people apart. I mean, there have been been surveys, and there's been a lot written about high rates of violence against women in American Indian communities and in Alaska Native villages. I did, you know, visited Alaska Native village and did find that there, you know, seemed to be high rates of violence there and a lack of law enforcement. But I do think that, that, you know, rape and sexual violence and domestic violence affects, you know, people from all walks of life.
We seem to be living in a rape culture, and we're hearing a lot of rhetoric from, you know, politicians or media figures about rape issues. Like, there was the whole Sandra Fleck controversy, and then I know during the last election a couple of politicians came out and were basically like, oh, you know, if the body is raped, the woman can't get pregnant. What would you say to a politician or any figure who makes that kind of blanket statement without the facts?
I mean, one thing that I really learned on my trip to Alaska and through reporting this is that, you know, it is really important when victims and survivors of rape and sexual violence come forward to be empathetic, to start from a position of believing them, to honor their stories, and to realize what a big deal it is for them to speak out about this. And I think it is that speaking out and breaking the silence that will stop the cycle of violence. I also think it's really, it seems incredibly obvious, but it's not always in the public debate. It's important to remember that, that rapists are to blame for rape. Like, I think too often blame gets assigned to victims, and that from, you know, people I met is just an incredibly damaging thing that can cause a lifetime of harm. So, I mean, that's what I would emphasize, the importance of, you know, standing with survivors of sexual violence who do come forward and remembering, you know, who's to blame in these situations. And every case is complicated, and, you know, and if when they go to trial, it can be, I'm not saying it's always 100% cut and dry. I just think, you know, that it's an incredibly powerful and brave thing for rape survivors to speak out and to come forward, and I think that needs to be respected.
Well, hey, Dan, we've just got time for one more question.
Yeah, that was my last question, so I was just about to wrap up.
Okay.
Well, the project is Change the List. You can visit at changethelist.com, or you can also go to CNN, and you can visit John D. Sutter at jdsutter.com. John Sutter, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Dan. The website is actually cnn.com/change.
cnn.com/change, perfect.
Yeah.
Alrighty, thank you. Cheers.
Yep.
Love it.
Bye.
Once again, that was CNN human rights and social change columnist John D. Sutter. You can read his pieces at cnn.com/change the list, or you can visit his personal website at jdsutter.com. Okay, we have another song coming up here from the Pack AD off of their album Do Not Engage. This is Creepin' Jenny. That was the Pack AD with the song Creeping Jenny off their new full-length album, Do Not Engage. And I had the chance to speak with the Pack AD a couple weeks ago just as they were starting on their tour. So I've got Becky here from the Pack AD. Hello.
Hello.
So your guys' new album is Do Not Engage. How would you say this album came about for you?
Well, basically we had a year off. We didn't tour, and we just recorded it, part of it in Detroit and part of it in Vancouver.
How, being a duo, how would you describe your guys' writing process? How closely do you work together in that regard?
Yeah, we pretty much just get together and come up with the songs together. I mean, yeah, most of the writing takes place when we're at home. I can totally hear my echo, and it's weirding me out.
What made you guys decide to sign with Network after your contract with Mint had expired?
Well, we didn't have a label, so we needed somebody to release it. So they came into the picture, and then we signed with them.
Being a duo that you're essentially just a singer guitarist and a drummer, what kind of sound does that give you as opposed to other bands who may be 3-4 or a 5-piece group?
Well, we don't have a bass player, so I mean, I guess that's fairly obvious. That makes it sound different on its own. I can't really do a lot of lead guitar, so I have to play sort of the rhythm, so that kind of makes the music really simple.
Would you say it gives a more sort of raw and experimental type of feel to the music?
I guess so. It's sort of limiting, but also, I don't know, there's endless things you can do in a way with only two instruments. There's not, like, it's limitless and limiting at the same time.
You've been described as sort of garage rock with a little bit of punk and blues. What would you say is at the heart of the Pack AD's sound?
I don't know. I mean, whatever. Genres are always kind of weird to me. Like, I never know what genre we fit in. We kind of jump around, so I don't know. I guess, yeah, that works. We usually say it's garage because it's rough. yeah.
So, would you say you have a favorite song off of Do Not Engage?
Right now, I'd say The Water.
What is it about that song in particular that speaks to you at this current junction?
I don't know. I like playing that song live, and I don't know. I'm kind of sick of listening to the album because I've heard it so many times. So I'm over most of the songs. But I guess there's a few of them that are less irritating at this point.
You guys are from Vancouver. What kind of city is Vancouver to be a working musician in, and specifically sort of a duo in the garage music scene?
I don't know. It's all right. I don't think. Vancouver gets a lot of flack, like no fun city, and I don't know, like as far as there's been a lot of music venues that have closed down and stuff, but a lot of ones have reopened, so I don't know, I don't think it's a bad city. It's expensive.
Are, being that, you know, a number of venues have closed down, like the Waldorf, are you worried at all for the arts about in this city?
No, because for every venue that closes down, a new one opens. I mean, or at least for every two that closes down, a new one opens. I don't know. There will always be a music scene.
Yeah. Favorite music venue in Vancouver?
I don't know. I really like the Commodore.
Everyone loves the Commodore, right? It seems to be the classic venue that everyone wants to play once in their life. Do you have, now you guys are just about to start your North American tour. How how would you say you prepare for going out on tour?
Just kind of try to relax and pack, you know, ahead of time, hopefully. I know I always end up packing last minute, like this morning. We're leaving right now, basically.
Do you have a favorite memory from touring over the years?
I honestly couldn't pick one out of all of them. It sort of all blurs together. But yeah.
And now you guys are playing in Vancouver on February 21st, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
Well, the album is Do Not Engage, Becky Black from the Pack ID. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
Alrighty, cheers. Have a good one.
You too.
Once again, that was the Pack ID, and I spoke to them on the road in Vancouver as they were just crossing to start their tour. Well, that about does it for this week for Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, on the internet at cjsf.ca, or tell us HD channel 7014. My thanks to the Pack AD. My thanks to John D. Suter from CNN's Change the List, cnn.com/changelist, or jdsuter.com. And of course, my thanks to Roddy Doyle, whose new book, The Guts, is out now. Stay tuned for my show next week, which will be Mick Foley, Dave Foley, and Brett Kissel. And we're going to take you out with the Pack AD's Positronic off their album Some Songs. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.